Good morning and welcome to Chief Among Friends. I'm your host, Dr. Chris Hobson, Chief Medical Officer at Orion Health. On this podcast, I chat about topics ranging from technology priorities to new innovations in integrated and coordinated care to healthcare sustainability. You can follow the conversation on hashtag Chief Among Friends and be sure to follow me on Twitter at Dr. Chris Hobson. Today, I'd like to talk about accountable care organisations and do that by looking in detail at a particularly successful example. Now, skeptics have sometimes been critical of the ACO model, with some debate as to whether savings are real or an artifact perhaps due to some other cause. For instance, as a result of high-cost providers leaving the ACO. Some of the poorer results may be attributed to growing pains as the healthcare industry adjusts to the new paradigm. However, some ACOs have achieved real success, not only in terms of cost reduction, but also in delivering improved quality care to patients. An ACO that I've been interested in for some time that has done particularly well is Innovation Care Partners based in Scottsdale, Arizona. Today, we are very fortunate to talk to one of the key people at ICP. Farron Thompson is the COO at Innovation Care Partners. Welcome, Farron.
Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here with you today.
Thank you so much. So, to get started, can you tell us a little bit more about Innovation Care Partners, please?
Sure. You've used the term accountable care organization. We're definitely an accountable care organization in its narrowest sense of a definition, which means we're part of the federal government's Medicare Shared Savings Program. And we're also a broader sense in the accountable care organization, really falling under a different term called clinical integration network. And basically, that means that we do accountable care organization-like things, but we have a lot of different other payer contracts besides the federal government. So we're now into the space with Medicare Advantage contracts, Medicaid contracts, and several commercial contracts as well. So that kind of makes us both an accountable care organization and a clinical integration network. We were formed in the middle of 2012 after a started initiative by the health system here locally in Scottsdale, formed really a couple of working groups that lasted a couple of years, hired some consultants and some attorneys to try and really figure out if it made sense to, you know, get something like this started in our community. And, you know, fortunately, everybody agreed that it seemed to make a lot of sense. And so we built the company from scratch, starting in 2012. And it was really, kind of supported heavily by the health system. But it, at that time, it was a joint venture with all of the physicians that joined the ACO at the time. And we started off with really simply a single payer contract, which was the employee health plan of the health system that was 50% owner of us. And since we started in the middle of the year, we used an attribution model and really only had about 1,500 patients. And we did a membership drive and had a pretty amazing response for a startup and had 430 physicians join us right out of the gate. We've grown tremendously since 2012 over the last 7 or so years and have had a lot of success, a lot of lessons learned along the way. That's how we got started.
That's very interesting. I wasn't actually aware of, used to the term clinical integration network, but not in specifically with around things like value-based care models. So perhaps what would be interesting, so what specific value-based care models, we've talked about the MSSP, what other value-based care models have you adopted or used at ICP?
Sure. Anybody who's familiar with value-based care knows the term glide path to risk, which is used a lot. And there's evolutionary steps that organizations can choose to go down to get to full downside risk contracts as a provider organization. So we've dabbled in just about everything, but we prefer to start with pretty simple shared savings contracts as our starting point. And, you know, we We want to make sure that we have a really good relationship with a payer, that data is flowing transparently and timely between the payers and us, and that we have a handle on the population. And we can do all that in a bit of a safe contractual environment by starting off with a shared savings contract where there's upside opportunities, but we're not at risk for any downside. But we certainly have had a lot of those contracts over the years. And then we have migrated into limited downside risk contracts like we have with the, we're in track two of the Medicare Shared Savings Program, where that has a 15% cap on downside risk for us, but it has a little bit higher upside risk. And then we've also entered into nearly full downside risk contracts with a payer in our market that did have a cap on the downside loss. And so we've been across the spectrum. I wouldn't say that we just haven't gone all the way yet into, you know, unlimited full downside risk contracts. We're still learning. I think, you know, the payers are the ones who really control the contractual dynamics and set the rules of this game that we're in. And, you know, we've learned a lot about that, and not every payer is equal in how they approach it. And so, you know, we've learned a lot, and we've learned that our success is not only tied directly to how we manage the care and how we engage our physicians and get them motivated to understand and practice in a value-based environment, but it's also very dependent on the strength and capabilities of the payers to have a successful relationship. And so we're pretty cautious about getting into downside risk and looking for, you know, multiple milestones to be met that make us confident that we're in an arrangement with a payer that will be successful long term.
And so presumably that's a best practice that you would probably recommend for other ACOs?
I certainly would. And you know, there's some ACOs tied to big health systems that, you know, are willing to throw money at something and just go deep into downside risk early on. That really just didn't fit our business structure of a joint venture that when we started this organization. It just didn't fit the mindset of any of the executives or our board or anything. We want to, you know, prove to our physician membership community, which now has grown to about 2,000 physicians, of which 1,700 of those physicians are private practice from all kinds of different primary care and specialist types of practices, everything you can imagine. And we want to prove to them that, you know, we know what we're doing, and we're not going to dive into situations where, you know, our first several years we're paying out millions of dollars in downside back to a payer. It's just not a place that any of us really wants to be in. So I certainly would, you know, follow that glide path and walk before you run.
Excellent, excellent. Actually, so just we'll go to this one next, actually. So you've mentioned the physicians. So what are your recommendations? I mean, if you've corralled 1,400 independent physicians, that's no mean feat. So based on
1,700.
1,700, even better. So what would your recommendations be for with respect to physician engagement?
Yeah, it's a great topic. Mm. You know, we get asked a lot one of two questions. You know, what's our approach to being an ACO, or what are our keys to success? And first and foremost, at the top of answering those questions is physician engagement. We feel that physician engagement is the number one contributing factor and has been the number one contributing factor to our success historically. We do a lot of different things to engage our physician population. And some of the examples of those are care management fees. So we make a commitment to reimburse primary care physicians on a quarterly basis for their attributed patient population. And the reason we do that is, you know, first of all, primary care is probably the lowest reimbursed physician type in the U.S., and they're stretched really thin. And we come around as an ACO and ask them to do a lot of work. And it is not trivial. So, you know, in exchange for all that work and for them paying attention, we're willing to pay them care management fees to think about how they take care of our patients a little bit differently, spend a little bit more time, do the quality reporting we need, pay attention to the new guidelines that we publish that could change how they're delivering their care. So we just ask a lot of primary care. And so we pay these care management fees, and that helps to get a lot of attention of primary care and a lot of engagement. We also pay gain share. So when we have earned enough shared savings across different payer plans, our board will declare a gain share distribution. And when we do that, we pay part of it goes to the hospital system, and the rest goes to physicians. But you know, all 2,000 physicians don't earn gain share. In order to be eligible for gain share, you know, there's a number of criteria, but a major criteria is they have to have earned what we call citizenship points. So we measure our physicians' participation in our organization lots of different ways, things like technology utilization, participation in meetings, participation in committees and specialist work groups. Lots of different methods for earning points, basically. Mm-hmm. So we have a minimum threshold that physicians must maintain in order to stay in our organization, otherwise they'll be terminated. And then we have another threshold of points that gets physicians eligible to be a participant in the gain share distribution. So when we do distribute gain share, and you know, I think in our history we've distributed over $30 million of gain share over three different distributions, you know, that helps to get people's attention and realize that, hey, yeah, this is working. And, you know, if I do some of the right things and pay attention to this value-based care model, I'm eligible for these when these do come around. I mentioned as part of citizenship points, we have points for meeting attendance. We do three all-member meetings a year, and we get a huge number of physicians turn out to that. We have to host them at very large conference facilities and resorts now because of the number of physicians that attend those meetings that happen three times a year. We have three specific all primary care meetings that happen throughout the year, and we're really just talking about things that we see evolving and things we're looking for the primary care population to be aware of moving forward. Then we require all of our primary care physicians to have a principal member of their organization meet with our leadership team on a quarterly basis. We deliver to them all kinds of reports and data, facts and figures about their participation in our organization. And we're talking about the things that we want them to do next and pay attention to. You know, we're talking about their specific patients and how more of them could be enrolled in our care coordination program, or the frequent flyer patients that are going to the emergency rooms too often and how to address that, or how they're using our technology, or how they could send more referrals in network. We're covering all of these broad topics in these quarterly meetings that are mandatory. And that's, oh, by the way, where we deliver the care management checks, too. So we don't just send those checks in the mail. So lots of different meeting types. We also have a highly engaged physician population in our governance committees. And we also have started in the past 2 years specialist work groups where we'll invite specialists of one or two different types to collaborate with us to solve a particular problem. For example, one of our earlier work groups that we started was we got ophthalmologists, retinal physicians, and PCPs in a room, and we talked about how to improve our quality metric capture around diabetic eye exams. So we tackled that, tried to figure out how to do that, and we came up with some really good solutions that we could apply. So what spun out of that was another topic around the use of brand name or generic drugs for macular degeneration. And, you know, we took the same approach with this as we take with all of our specialty work groups. We kind of provide facts and data to the group, and we just kind of ask questions and then see where they go with it. And, you know, we found out a lot about how these brand name drugs have rebates associated with them, and talked about how we can try and get our population to use the much cheaper but virtually as effective generic drugs. So we tackle specific topics with the specialist work groups and get a high amount of participation and engagement. And we're not the ones that are telling them what to do. All we're doing is bringing them together, posing a problem, supplying them with the data that they asked for, and let them try and problem solve. So you get a lot better buy-in when you involve the physicians in the solution rather than coming around and just telling them they have to do something different. And then a couple other things we do around physician engagement, and sorry I'm going long on this, but it really is.
Not at all. I think it's the most important topic.
It really is key to our success, so we could talk about it all day. Mm. We have a team of what's called physician practice liaisons, and they have a practice book of business of about 60 to 70 practices. And they do the onboarding when a physician and a practice joins us. They train them in our technologies, and then they... Any, you know, new things we have, campaigns of information, they're the ones that are responsible for building and maintaining a long-term relationship with the practice and being that conduit to our organization. So that really keeps practices and physicians knowing that we care, mm-hmm. we're watching, mm-hmm. we're paying attention to your engagement, and we're here to help you become better engaged in our organization over time. And then the last thing is just we have a lot of different technologies that we've invested in. I would guess probably much more so than a lot of ACOs. And a lot of that technology is specifically geared to helping our physicians and practices practice better medicine, and to do so in as few clicks and as painless as possible, in a really value-added way of doing that. So a lot of physicians absolutely love the technologies that we've given them. It connects them better to their peers, and it gives them clinical data at their fingertips that they didn't have before. So just a lot of different technologies that make sense for them, add value, and improve engagement. And, you know, if they're looking up patient information in our Orion Health Information Exchange, for example, and they see that, you know, there's imaging studies or there's lab tests that have been ordered in the past, and here's the values, you know, they don't need to order them, and that benefits us, it benefits the patient, it benefits everybody by saving cost and utilization on an already overburdened health system. So the technologies add a lot of value to them in their mm-hmm. daily lives, but it also trickles down to us and what we're trying to drive forward with.
So I really think you've done a fantastic job in the way both that you set up the ACO and the way that you've got the physician engagement. I was a primary care physician in New Zealand for 10 years, and we had some of the very similar ideas, but where we probably just didn't do nearly as well as the things that you've done. I would sit there and get random reports, and then I would say, yeah, but that's not, you know, that's not complete detail. There's more to it than this. We had a campaign to run more generic drugs, for instance, you just reminded me. But as physicians, we weren't in a position to kind of argue whether they were pushing the right. In your example with the macular degeneration, you had the specialist, so you had the close relationship with the physician. So, and as you described, you were able to answer questions, because that was probably the gap in what we did. Was, well, okay, yeah, but you don't fully understand, or you don't want things that are imposed from above. And so I really think Scottsdale Health Partners represents a best practice in many, many fronts in how to do this. And also interested that you said that they like the technology, and as we know, getting physicians to like technology is, that's also a challenge. So there's the engagement in the business model, and then there's the engagement in using the technology, and you seem to have been able to do both, which again is full credit to you. So let's just focus for a second on the Health Information Exchange. So how much does that contribute to the success of the ACO? And are you looking at other data types that might be relevant?
Yeah, it was our kind of our biggest technology that we implemented. It was one of two technologies that were identified even before we started the company that we had to have, that was key to the success of an ACO, and that was sorely needed in the community of physicians and practices here. And so it was a big thing for us. It's still kind of our core technology that we have, and we've grown the use of our health information exchange tremendously over time. One of the key reasons we chose Orion's platform back when we did in 2013 was because it was kind of an open architected solution. And, you know, we weren't locked into, we can get three enhancements every year if we go to the user group and we vote the same way that everybody else does. We felt confident that there would be a lot of evolutionary needs that we could program in and configure ourselves with Orion's platform, and that's proven to be the case. So we've enhanced the value of the out-of-the-box offering tremendously that meets our specific needs of not only our organization, but the specific needs of our physician community. For example, we've gotten into bundled payments program, and they're identifying the patients that are a candidate for a bundle or are for sure in a bundle, and then letting transition care managers know that and hospitalists know that. That's really key to being successful in bundled payments, is you have to identify the patient at the right time to be able to put the right wheels in motion. And so we've been able to add lots of different types of censuses into the health information exchange using the data that's there, and adding in, using the custom configuration and programming capability that we have, to add a lot more value to our specific business cases. And we're like any probably HIE user, we have really just a lot of clinical data in the HIE, and we've over the past couple of years really been able to expand to get data on our patients from a tremendous amount of sources in Arizona, which really makes it more and more valuable and saves that duplication even more when you have lots and lots of different data sources in there. We do have also claims data, but those go into our analytics systems, not so much into our HIE, but we're seeing that there's benefit in having a convergence of some of the payer claims data for things like quality metrics. Would be good to have that commingled in with the HIE as a single data source to help with our quality reporting initiatives and our analytics. And then, of course, the buzzword that everybody's talking about these days is SDOH, or social determinants of health. Easy for me to say. That's going to be critically important in our organization, because we're trying to really identify how to get people identified proactively and assign care coordinators to them early, so we can avoid emergency visits and readmissions and things like that. And interestingly, we've really been in the social determinants business here with our care management program really since we launched it in 2014. So before it became the biggest buzzword in healthcare, we were knee deep in it, because our care coordinators are assigned to primary care offices, and they are meant to build a long-term relationship with the patients that have multiple chronic conditions. And they really, one way to think of them is they kind of become a bit of a life/health coach. And a lot of what they deal with are the social determinants that patients deal with on a daily basis, like access to transportation, or are they getting the right kind of nutrition, Are they getting the right kind of exercise? Do they have the right people to help take care of them in their home? All of the different barriers why patients are not healthy are not always medically related. In fact, 99% of the time, they're not medically related. It's these social determinants. So our staff builds the relationships, they build the trust, they go into the homes, they understand the environments, and they keep track of all of this information that's very granular about patients so that they can find the right resources in the community, work with the payer to fund different things that the patients need that will keep them out of the hospital, keep them healthy, prolong their lives. And all of this is social determinants. And so we've been living it, acting it for years. Now we're at a point where we need to capture electronically more of this data and then use it in solutions like machine learning, where we can really untap more value of that data and get further ahead of identifying the patients that are likely to have future chronic conditions, high cost episodes, early death, that sort of thing. And we can, you know, really more target the patients that we really need to be targeting.
So just a couple of sort of related questions just quickly. Do you see that it would be valuable to have some social determinant data on all your population, or does it make much more sense just to have it on patients as they're going through kind of care coordination exercise?
No, clearly we'd love to have it on all of our population. We have about 155,000 covered lives across all those different payer types I mentioned earlier. But yeah, the more of this that we could have, the more we could target the patients. Because, you know, if you get introduced to a patient for care coordination, you know, how many did you not get introduced to? You know, and are we always focusing our limited resources on the right set of patients for care coordination? And I think if we had more social determinants data, along with the clinical data, along with the claims data, and advanced analytics processing like you can get from machine learning, we would have a lot higher confidence that we're finding the patients that need the attention and need it sooner rather than later. So I think we could be even more effective if we had that on a much broader set of patients. The challenge is, you know, getting it and then doing something with it.
No, that's excellent. So one of the topics that comes up a lot in discussion is about patient involvement in their own care, patient engagement, patient empowerment. Where have you got to with that side of the coin from an ICP perspective?
Sure. And you're probably thinking, you know, there's some sexy technology answers with, you know, Fitbits or telemedicine or something. And I think we're moving in that direction. We're certainly investigating a lot of telemedicine, telehealth, virtual health strategies to extend our effectiveness and our efficiency. But we've done a lot of patient engagement, but it's really been more through our care management programs. And that has two aspects. I mentioned care coordinators a few minutes ago. And, you know, those care coordinators are specially trained. They go through a six or so week program with us, and they learn to be a good care coordinator. They learn how to properly interview patients so that they can do behavioral modification, interviewing, and try and get patients slowly over time to be more interested in their own health and their own health care. And we do a lot of different assessments and measures of patient engagement. We use the PAM, which is patient activation measure, for example. And, you know, we use that as a baseline, and then we remeasure that every 6 months with our patients that are in our care management program, because, you know, we want them to be happy and successful in their life. And a lot of these are elderly patients, and, you know, their conditions are preventing them from being happy and healthy. And so if we can not focus on the medical goals, but focus on their life goals, which could be as simple as, you know, it'd be really nice if I could get off the couch and go get my own mail every day. Or it could be something, you know, more extravagant, like, you know, my grandson is graduating from high school at the end of the spring, and I would like to be able to drive across country to go see my grandson graduate. Or who knows what those life goals are, but we try and understand those, we try and get them motivated to set small goals, and then we work with them incrementally over time to try and improve their health status by removing those barriers with the patients and getting them more and more engaged in their own care. And there's definitely studies that show there's a high correlation between how actively engaged patients are in their health and their belief that they can control their destiny, and it's not a fatalistic attitude. And there's lots of studies that show there's a direct correlation in long, you know, life expectancy and the cost of care of those patients. So our team spends a lot of time really focusing on engaging patients that way.
Now, I like that. I like that discussion a lot. I think if we can focus the care, you know, I've been saying outcomes that matter to patients. Could you perhaps outline some of the highlights with respect to outcomes achieved by Innovation Care Partners?
Yeah, certainly. We've had a lot of success, a lot of lessons learned, and you know, the interesting thing is, you know, I think our executive team realizes we're only just scratching the surface here. There's a lot more opportunity and improvement we can squeeze out of healthcare over time. But you know, probably the most notable success measure is the cost savings success we've had in the Medicare Shared Savings mm-hmm. Program. We entered that program in 2014. And over a 5-year period, we saved CMS $82 million compared to their benchmark expectations, which resulted in a cumulative $37 million of shared savings coming to Innovation Care Partners over those 5 years. So, you know, that's been a tremendous big win for us. You know, around that program, we're the only ACO in Arizona, the only Medicare Shared Savings Program ACO in Arizona that earned shared savings in our first year and has earned shared savings every year of our existence. So we're pretty proud of that fact in Arizona and hope to continue that track record moving forward. We've had a lot of other payer contracts where we've saved them millions of dollars year over year. We've been able to move the quality needle with a lot of our patient population and help, for example, Medicare Advantage plans achieve 4 stars ratings with CMS. And, you know, but I think the best thing about all this is, you know, these are nice statistics and they help us with our plowing money back into the organization and rewarding the participants that are moving the healthcare needle. But you know, all of these things that we do, and you know, those, when you get down to the patient and you think about what we're doing for patients, and we have this, as I've mentioned, we have this great relationship with our primary care physicians, and we have these care managers that build these relationships with our patients. So for me and a lot of the folks that work here, we love hearing the patient stories and how did our engagement, mm-hmm. you know, dramatically change a patient's life. Mm-hmm. And when you hear these stories and how impactful they are, you know, that's really what gets me to keep coming mm-hmm. back to work, is that it's not that we save the federal government money. Yeah. That's a nice byproduct for mm-hmm. me, but knowing that we're really making a difference in patients' lives through our actions. And as we're doing that, you know, we're improving cost, which we know is out of control in the U.S. So we're doing our part to move that needle, but we're really making a difference in patients' lives. So the more we can continue to grow, the more contracts we get, the more covered lives we get, you know, the better we can fulfill that goal of, you know, really making a difference every day with our patient population.
Oh, that's fantastic, Farron. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
If you'd like to join us for future episodes of this podcast, please follow us on #ChiefAmongFriends and on Twitter @DrChrisHobson.